We hope this explanation of God's Word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com.
Look at rest first up, aren't we? And the biblical perspective on that. So let's start with some of the things that you've already looked at. That is the conflict between the accounts of the Ten Commandments, Exodus chapter 20. Exodus chapter 20, verse 8. Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labour and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you nor your son or daughter, nor your manservant nor maidservant, nor your animals, nor the alien within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them. But he rested on the seventh day, and therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. When we come to Deuteronomy chapter 5, and again the Ten Commandments are given, Deuteronomy chapter 5, we read in verse 12, observe the Sabbath day by keeping it holy, as the Lord your God has commanded you. 6 days you shall labour and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you, nor your son, nor daughter, your manservant, your maidservant, nor your ox, nor your donkey, nor any of your animals, nor the alien within your gates, so that your manservant and maidservant may rest as you do. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt, and that the Lord your God brought you out of there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore the Lord your God has commanded you to observe the Sabbath day. Now there are minor verbal differences, word differences between the two commandments, except verse 15 of Deuteronomy 5 sees that the reason you observe the Sabbath day is because you were slaves in Egypt. That God rescued you is the reason. Whereas the reason in Exodus chapter 20 verse 11 is the creation, because this is the way in which God created the world. That's a little bit more than just verbal differences from one set of commandments to the other. Why are they so different? We come to Mark chapter 2. Mark chapter 2, which I think you also have looked at briefly in the last day or so. We have Jesus in conflict, as he is throughout this section of the gospel. In Mark chapter 2, firstly in verses 1 to 12, he heals the paralytic who's let down through the roof, and that arouses conflict because he actually professes to have the authority to forgive sins. He then, in verses 13 following, calls Levi, the tax collector, to be one of his disciples and goes and eats with him. And the Pharisees are upset with him that he's eating with sinners and tax collectors. Then the disciples of John in verse 18 and the Pharisees question Jesus about fasting. Jesus' disciples don't practice fasting as John has taught his disciples, and the Pharisees have taught their disciples to fast. Jesus is feasting, and he talks about being with the bridegroom at the time of the wedding and how you can't fast then. And it goes on about no one sews, verse 21, a patch of unshrunk cloth on an old garment. If he does, the new piece will pull away from the old, making the tear worse. And no one pours new wine into old wineskins. If he does, the wine will burst the skins, and both the wine and the wineskins will be ruined. No, he pours new wine into new wineskins. But there is some new thing here which is not to be conjoined to the old, but is disjoined. It's a disjunction, not a conjunction. It's something new. It's a separate thing that is taking place that you just can't match in because it's so new and the old that it's replacing won't hold together. Then he goes on the subject of the Sabbath. Jesus going through the grain field and his disciples walking along, picking the ears of corn and eating it. And again he is challenged about his disciples not observing Sabbath law, to which Jesus gives the example of David and then concludes with the Sabbath, verse 27, was made for man, not man for the Sabbath, so the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. And then another time he went into the synagogue, chapter 3, and a man with a shriveled hand was there, and some of them were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus, so they watched closely to see if he would heal on the Sabbath. And Jesus gets the man to stand up and says, which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil, to save life or to kill? And they remained silent, and he looked around at them in anger and deeply distressed at their stubborn hearts and said, stretch out your hand, and the man was cured. One of the great conflict areas, we could see it in Luke chapter 13 also, which I think you looked at, one of the great conflict areas Jesus is consistently in is the subject of the Sabbath, of what you can do and can't do on the Sabbath, and whether he can heal people on the Sabbath. But it's not just the healing of people, it's also got to do with his disciples. And this great claim of verse 28, chapter 2, that the Son of Man, which can be man himself or it could be Jesus, is the Lord even of the Sabbath. Throughout the Old Testament, the people of God are to uphold Sabbath laws. Come back with me to Exodus chapter 31. Exodus chapter 31. Exodus chapter 31. Verse 12. Then the Lord said to Moses, say to the Israelites, you must observe my Sabbaths. This will be a sign between me and you for the generations to come, so that you may know that I am the Lord, who makes you holy. Observe the Sabbath, because it is holy to you. Anyone who desecrates it must be put to death. Whoever does any work on that day must be cut off from his people. For 6 days' work is to be done, but the seventh day is a Sabbath of the rest, of holy to the Lord. Whoever does any work on the Sabbath day must be put to death. The Israelites are to observe the Sabbath, celebrating it in the generations to come. As a lasting covenant, it will be a sign between me and the Israelites forever. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, and on the seventh day he abstained from work and rested. There's not all that many laws in the Old Testament that involve capital punishment. But Sabbath observance is one that involves capital punishment. If you work, if you defile the Sabbath, then you are to be executed in the law of Israel, in Exodus 31. But when you come across to the New Testament in Romans 14, Paul discusses Christian freedom. Romans 14, verse 5. One man considers one day more sacred than another. Another man considers every day alike. Each one should be fully convinced in his own mind. He who regards one day as special does so to the Lord. He who eats meat eats to the Lord, for he gives thanks to God. And he who abstains does so to the Lord and gives thanks to God. For none of us lives to himself alone, none of us dies to himself alone. If we live, we live for the Lord, and if we die, we die for the Lord. So whether we live or die, we belong to the Lord. It seems as if there are some Christians who will take one day as being important, and they are doing the right thing if they do, but there are other Christians now who will not take one day as being important. They'll say every day is just the same as every other day, and they also are right. There seems to be no Sabbath construction of the week in Romans 14. In fact, when we go across to the passage in Colossians 2, we see that Paul fiercely defends the liberty of the Christian, even in relationship to the Sabbaths. So verse 16, therefore, 2:16 of Colossians, therefore, do not let anyone judge you by what you eat or drink, or with regard to a religious festival or new moon celebration or a Sabbath day. These are a shadow of the things that were to come. The reality, however, is found in Christ. But all the food laws, the what you eat, what you drink, etc., but more than that, religious festivities, new moon celebrations, and indeed Sabbaths, Colossians 2:16-17, even Sabbath days, are seen not as the reality of Christian religion, but a shadow of the reality that's to come, and therefore not something that we should be pass judgment over. We mustn't allow people to pass judgment over us here. So something which was so important in the Exodus, that anyone who defiles it or breaks it is to be executed, is by the time of Colossians something over which we should not allow anyone to pass any judgment on us. Indeed, it's only a shadow of the reality. It's not surprising then, given what I've just spelt out in the last few minutes, that most Christians are confused about the Sabbath. It is all fairly confusing stuff, isn't it? Here in the Ten Commandments is a law which it seems Paul in Colossians is putting aside. All the other commandments, fairly straightforward. You shall have no other God but me. Well, you don't put that one aside. You shall not kill. Well, you don't put that one aside. You shall not steal. You don't put that one aside. You shall not commit adultery. You don't put that one aside. But here's one that seems to be put aside in the New Testament. It's a very strange thing. Indeed, it's different to the others too. The others you can work out some logic about, can't you? Given monotheism, well then of course you can't make any other God. Can't have any other gods. Given that God is spirit, well of course you can't have the physical representation of him. Given that that God is moral, you can understand about law keeping in terms of adultery, theft, murder, covetousness. But the Sabbath seems to be an arbitrary thing, seems to be a kind of religious ritual, seems to be part of cultic activity rather than anything logical about God himself or about morality itself. I mean, why 1 in 7? Why not 1 in 10? Or 2 in 4, as the average Australian would like it to be. Why do we have to limit, why do we come to that kind of figure? Why resting? Within Christianity, there has been long debates about the Sabbath. Which day of the week must be the Sabbath? So there are two groups, for example, that are very well known, the three groups well known. There's the that celebrate the Sabbath not on Sundays. The Seventh-day Baptists, of whom there's a few congregations around Sydney. The Seventh-day Adventists, who are much better known. The Herbert W. Armstrong group, the Radio Church of the World, which I think has funny Sabbath laws, but I'm pretty sure it celebrates Sabbath on Saturdays. To say nothing, of course, of the Jews, who continue to celebrate a Saturday Sabbath. There are other groups, such as Presbyterianism, which fiercely hold to Sabbatarianism being on Sundays, and especially in the 19th century, amongst English-speaking people, Bible-believing people, the Lord's Day Observance Committee became a very important thing, that all the laws about the Sabbath were caught up and applied to the Lord's Day, as it was called, that is, Sunday. And so you get a man like the Chariots of Fire man, the great runner of the earlier part of this century, Eric Liddell, who refused to run in the Olympics on the Sunday because that... he thought was a defilement of the Lord's Day. A very great and godly man who later perished in a prisoner of war camp in China, where he was serving as a missionary. He perished of cancer, in fact, but there was a man of tremendous integrity and conscience. The same is true of the New Zealand All Black team at the moment. Those of you who follow rugby, and those of you who don't, you should, and those of you who don't, that there is a breakaway whose surname is Jones, playing for the All Blacks, who is, I would think, the greatest breakaway playing the game of the world today. He is so great, the All Blacks keep putting up with him because he keeps refusing to play on Sundays. So every time there's a test match on a Sunday, the All Blacks have to do without Mr Jones, and they put in Zimzam Brooks instead. But as soon as there's a the game falls on any other day, then Mr Jones will play. And again, it's got to do with his conscience. But he believes that it's not right to be playing rugby on a Sunday, because that is the Lord's Day, that is the Sabbath, and it would break his conscience. So at one level, you see, you've got Christian groups who still hold to that view, while there are other people who don't mind in the slightest playing football on a Sunday, or cricket, or anything else on a Sunday. That it's just like every other day as far as they're concerned. There are some people I know who even have church on Friday nights. Now, what is this all about, this Sabbath and this rest business? The Sabbath has two rationales lying behind it in the Old Testament that turn out to be the same, but they at least start out differently. The first one is that the Sabbath day is a covenant sign, a contract sign, that the creator of the world is the God of Israel. And makes Israel holy. I'll give you that line again. That's the covenant sign that the creator of the world is the God of Israel, who makes Israel holy, different, distinctive, separate. In the ancient world, every religion, every nationality had its gods, or its god, nearly always gods, and a little bit like mascots in some senses. You know, you trotted out your god, my god's more powerful than your god because he's the god of our nation's more powerful than your nation, therefore our god's more powerful than your god, and so on. The Israelites had the most arrogant claim of all. They claimed, my god is actually the god of all gods. My god is the god who created everything. In fact, all the other gods don't exist at all. Now, that is makes them fairly unpopular amongst other nations. It's the claim that the creator of the universe is their God. And the sign that they were the people of the creator was that they were to celebrate the Sabbath day. Now, it's that passage I just read a few minutes ago, Exodus chapter 31, which gives this rationale, this reason, this explanation of the covenant sign, of the Sabbath. Observe the Sabbath because it is holy to you. Sorry. You must observe my Sabbaths. This will be a sign between me and you for generations to come, that you may know that I am the Lord who makes you holy. Observe the Sabbath because it is holy to you. Anyone who desecrates it must be put to death, and so on. For 6 days work is to be done, but the seventh day is a Sabbath rest, holy to the Lord. The Israelites are to observe the Sabbath, celebrating it for generations as a lasting covenant. It will be a sign between me and the Israelites forever, because in 6 days the Lord made heaven and the earth, and on the seventh day he abstained from the work and rested it. Because I, the Creator, worked 6 days and rested one, and because you are the Creator's people, you must work 6 days and rest one. Because the way you work and rest symbolises that you are my people. Because I work and rest in this fashion. Now that sign lies behind the Ten Commandments one then, in Exodus 20. That the reason you are to work and rest 6 days and then one day is because that is the way God created the world. And you are the Israelites, the people of the Creator. And therefore you must demonstrate being the people of the Creator by working and resting in the same way in which he works and rests. Now, built into this idea of creation and symbolising creation by the Creator by working in rest is the whole notion that God's whole existence is not taken up in his work. That God himself rests. I don't know whether you've pondered it or not, but that God works is an extraordinary thing. Most of the gods of the ancient world didn't work. You employ other people to work. You own slaves to work. It was the God of Israel who was a worker. To have a worker God is in itself an extraordinary thing. You might like to ponder of other gods you know of. They're involved in all kinds of things, but rarely are they involved in work. That's an unusual thing. But that he rests, that he has holidays, is also unusual and extraordinary. He has both those things, that all the works of the universe do not occupy him totally. That he even has more, there's more to life for God than just the work he does. He rests as well. And not only that, but that is the character of the world. That all the production of the world is not sufficient. The world needs to rest as well. Come back in Exodus, for example, to chapter 23, verse 10. Exodus 23, 10 through to 12. For 6 days you are to sow your fields and harvest the crops, but during this, sorry, for 6 years you are to sow your fields and harvest the crops, but during the seventh year let the land lie unploughed and unused. Then the poor among your people may get food from it, and the wild animals may eat what they leave. Do the same with your vineyard and your olive grove. 6 days do your work, but on the seventh day do not work, so that your ox and your donkey may rest, and the slave born in your household, and the alien as well, may be refreshed. God sees a pattern in the world, a pattern that the world itself needs rest and relaxation and refreshment. That to constantly plough the same field year after year is in the end to destroy it, because the field itself needs refreshment. Recognising this is written some 3,000 years, something like that, before the idea of rotation of crops was ever understood. It's an extraordinary statement, isn't it? The understanding that the fields themselves need rest, as indeed do the ox and the ass, as indeed do humans. That refreshment and rest is an important thing, because we are created with that need. It is the habits of greedy humans to always want to try and squeeze more out of the world than you can. The battery hens who work a 10-day week is a good example of where humanity is. I mean, if we could do that with everybody and anything, we can. In fact, that's the character of the whole factory and industrialisation, isn't it? Whereby we try and squeeze as much work out of the factories as we can, but God says resting and refreshing and relaxation, etc., all important. Important even for your donkey, even for your slave, even for the stranger who's in your country, the alien as well. That's part of it. Come to Leviticus 25. Leviticus 25. Verses 1 to 7, and you'll get the same thing, so I won't read it for you. It'll make the same point. So here's the first side of the Sabbath, of the 1 in 7 pattern. The first side is that God created the world like this, and we need to take a day off because that's the way we've been created, and we need to have the world taking a day off because the world needs it. And if you are the people of God, then by taking a day off each week and working 6 days each week is to symbolise that you are the people of God, because that is the way God himself acts and reacts and lives. And the second theme about the rest, the Sabbath, is seemingly quite different. That is, the rest is not a time off, is not a relaxation and a refreshment. The rest is the land of inheritance. The rest is the land of inheritance. God had promised to Abram and Isaac and Jacob that they would inherit the land, Palestine, Israel. And so the story of the Old Testament and the Exodus especially and so on, that story, thank you, Brother, is the story of acquiring their inheritance. I don't know if you're heirs and heiresses of things, but most of our heirs and heiresses now acquire their inheritance through the death of the relative. But this is not through the death of the relative. This is through God working out his purposes to give them their inheritance, their land. That land of inheritance is called the rest. Where do we start? Exodus 33:14. Exodus 33:14. Here it is ambiguous. Moses in verse 12 says to the Lord, "You've been telling me to lead these people, but you've not let me know whom you will send with me. You have said, I know you by name, and you have found favour with me. If you are pleased with me, teach me your ways, so that I may know you and continue to find favour with you. Remember, this nation is your people." And the Lord replied, "My presence will go with you, and I will give you rest." What does that mean? I'll give you a holiday. I'll give you a break. Well, it can mean that. But it's going to be more. How and when does God give his people rest? Come to Deuteronomy 12. Deuteronomy 12. And I'm picking up from verse 8. Deuteronomy 12, verse 8 through to 10. "You are not to do as we do here today, everyone as he sees fit. Since you have not yet reached the resting place and the inheritance the Lord your God is giving you, but you will cross the Jordan and settle in the land the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, and he will give you rest from all your enemies around you, so that you will live in safety. Then to the place the Lord your God will choose as a name, dwelling place, etc." That is, here are the people of Israel. They've just got themselves out from Pharaoh and from slavery and from the terrible bondage. They have crossed the Red Sea. They have crossed the wilderness. They have reached the edge of the promised land, and then they've sinned, and so been sent on a long journey for 38 more years, etc., wandering in the wilderness. And as they wander, they are attacked by all kinds of people. And as they come up to the promised land, they are again attacked by people. And now God is saying, "I'm about to give you rest from your enemies." That is, I'm about to give you the promised land. When you come into the promised land, you will be at rest. No longer wandering, no longer fighting, but at rest. And so the promised land becomes the land of rest. You see how it's linked in there? "Since you have not yet reached the resting place and the inheritance the Lord has given you. And the Lord your God is giving you an inheritance, and he will give you rest from all your enemies." 25:19 of Deuteronomy, Deuteronomy 25:19. Beginning up from verse 17, 25:17, "Remember what the Amalekites did to you along the way when you came out of Egypt. When you were weary and worn out, they met you on your journey and cut off all those who were lagging behind. They had no fear of God. When the Lord your God gives you rest from all the enemies around you in the land he is giving you to possess an inheritance, you shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. Do not forget. See, the Amalekites, they gave you a rough time, but when you get into the promised land, you'll have rest. No longer will you be pressured by them, no longer will you be anxious by them, no longer will you be worried about those who are dragging behind because they've been knocked off by the Amalekites. You, when you come to your own land, that is my land, the land I'm giving you, will come to rest. So the promised land is for the people of Israel the land of rest. That is God's rest for them. Now, with that in mind, Psalm 95 makes much of the fact that the people of God did not get to the land of rest. Psalm 95. How are we going? You're keeping on board. We're doing a lot of Bible flipping, moving very fast, taking notes, going in one ear, down through the up through the brain, down through the right arm, onto the page. Is it also making sense so far? Do you see where we're going? Taking notes, going in one ear, down through the up through the brain, down through the right arm, onto the page. Is it also making sense so far? Do you see where we're going? Happy? You want to ask questions? Psalm 95? Well, we'll get to questions as we go down the track. A lot of content coming so far. Yep?
Why do you need rest to get such problems
to
Israel that we are not
going
to the land
of Israel? You and I?
Yeah.
Aren't you going to Israel? I reckon you've missed out, haven't you? We'll come to that. Yep. So hang on to it, Annie. It's a right question. And we're pretty close to it, actually. Psalm 95 sings the praises of God, verse 3. The Lord is a great God, a great king above all gods. In his hands are the depths of the earth. The mountain peaks belong to him. The sea is his, and he made it, and he hands. Here is the creator God. Come, let's bow down and worship before the Lord, our maker, for he is God, and we are his people. Verse 7. For he is our God, and we are the people of his pasture, the flock under his care. Today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as you did at Meribah and as you did at Massah in the desert. Going across the wilderness, twice the people of Israel, at Meribah and at Massah, their places in the wilderness, put God to the test instead of trusting him. And because they put him to the test, demanding water and food, etc., God condemned them to be lost in the wilderness. Do not harden your hearts as you did at Meribah and the day at Massah in the desert, when your fathers tested and tried me, though they had seen what I did. For 40 years I was angry with this generation. I said, they are a people whose hearts go astray, and they have not known my ways. So I declared on oath in my anger, they shall never enter my rest. That generation out in the wilderness, because they didn't obey God's word, because they didn't trust God's word, because they put God to the test, that generation in the wilderness did not enter the rest. What rest? The promised land. That generation all died out in the wilderness. That's why they wandered for 40 years, because they had to die off. And the next generation coming who would enter into God's rest, that is the promised land. In Jeremiah 31, there is a promise there by God of restoration to the people of Israel. Jeremiah is about in the middle of the Bible. Plonk open in the middle, and if you hit Isaiah, you need to go to the back, and if you hit Ezekiel, you need to go to the front. He's somewhere between Isaiah and Ezekiel. The people are threatened in Jeremiah's time with the fall of Jerusalem and the scattering of the people of God all through the nations once more, especially into slavery in Babylon. But there is a promise of restoration. At that time, declares the Lord, I will be the God of all the clans of Israel, and they will be my people. And this is what the Lord says. The people who survive the sword will find favour in the desert. I will come to give rest to Israel. The Lord appeared to us in the past, saying, I have loved you with an everlasting love. I have drawn you with loving kindness, and I will build you up again, and you will be built, O virgin Israel. Again you will take up your tambourines and go out to dance with the joyful. Again you will plant vineyards on the hills of Samaria, and the farmers will plant them and enjoy their fruit. And there will be a day when the watchmen will cry out on the hills of Ephraim, Come, let's go to Zion to the Lord our God. And so it goes on with the picture of great, joyous, happy celebration of living in the land of Israel once more in safety and security and joy and happiness and prosperity. God's promise is all caught up, though, in terms of rest given to Israel. So then, there are two uses of rest, of Sabbath, within two themes that are running down. One is that the people of Israel are to keep resting because God is the creator, their God. And the way in which God created the world was working 6 days and resting one. And so they are to follow that pattern that's built into the very nature of the world, that we need to work and rest. We need refreshment. And to see that, as with God, the whole of the world, the whole of life is not work. There is also rest. And secondly, the rest is a way of talking about heaven. It's a way of talking about the land, the promised land, the land of inheritance. It's a way of talking about where God is taking his people. That God's plan is for his people find rest from their enemies, from their labour, from their turmoil, from their strife, from their hardship, the rest of the promised land. Now, both these refer back to Genesis chapter 2. For the first reference to this work and rest routine is back there in the opening verses of Genesis 2. Thus the heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array. By the seventh day, God had finished the work he had been doing. So on the seventh day, he rested from all his work. And God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. The pattern of Genesis 1 is creation in 6 days. For some strange reason I've never really understood, the story is finished at verse 31 of chapter 6 and a new chapter starts, but the cycle really continues through to chapter 2, verse 3, or the end of verse 3. That is, the seventh day. The end point of creation is not the man and woman of course meant there, is not the man created in the sixth day. The end point of creation is rest. That is the end point. The great highlight, the great high point of it all, is ultimately its destiny. That is a seventh day of rest. Seven becomes, to the Israelite, the perfect number, the complete number, which is not a mathematical thing, it's a symbolic thing, a little bit like the Chinese 888 kind of figure, which previously you've told me symbolises wealth, prosperity, that kind of thing, doesn't it? And so when you see the number plate NG888, you know that it really shouldn't be on a broken down bomb, but on a Rolls Royce or something like that. Well, seven, you see, is the picture that's not unlike eight. It's not unlike it. It's the picture of prosperity, of wealth, of relaxation, but it's more of refreshment and relaxation, of holidays and happiness, of refreshment, of breaking out of work and getting into what you're working for. That is not work. You're working for the seventh day when you take a break, when you have a relaxation, when you refresh yourself, that God's purpose is not taken up in work. God's purpose is to work for something else, that is the day of relaxation, the day of refreshment, the day of holiday, the holy day, the separate day. So that the purpose of the world is not found in the world itself. God's purpose for the world is something beyond the 6 days that it took to make the world. It's to actually be in relationship with God. It's outside of work. It's beyond work. That is, God has a plan for this world. A plan which we participate in weekly when we take a day off. Like Exodus 20 commands. A plan which we come to when God brings us into his promised rest, like the Deuteronomy command proclaims. That is, every week when I take a day off, I am sharing in the Creator and his way of living. I'm sharing in the purpose of God for the world. But when God saves me and brings me to the promised land, I am really sharing in God's plans and purposes. Each week's day off is a foretaste of the ultimate purpose, when the whole world comes to rest. God's plan for creation, that is rest, is achieved in redemption, that is rescuing his people for his promised land of rest. The two themes are actually reflecting each other. God created the world in order to redeem a people. God's purpose all along was not just to have a world that worked, but to have a world that would rest with him. The way in which he brings people into that rest is by rescuing them through salvation. And so what Deuteronomy is commanding the people of Israel to do, and the reason for doing it, and what Exodus is commanding them to do and the reason for doing it, really is in the end the same thing. For the reason God created the world was so as to redeem a people who would rest in relationship with him, who would relax with him, who would be outside of the work world with him. But the Old Testament people never found that rest. They didn't find it in the Exodus. That generation were all cut off. But they didn't find it at any time. Because when the psalm was written, of which I read to you a few minutes ago, Psalm 95, they were living in the promised land. And yet the psalmist is still saying to them, beware or you won't enter into the rest. That is, the promised land of Israel, of Palestine, was not ultimately the rest that God had in mind. For that generation crossing the wilderness, looking forward to the promised land, it was going to be a great rest. But that was only a shadow of the reality to come. That was only a foretaste of the reality to come. That was only a symbol of the reality to come. The reality to come was heaven itself. So Annie has on her passport that she's not allowed into Israel. But that doesn't matter. What is important is, has she got on her passport accepted into heaven? That is the real promised land of rest. The promised land is a picture of heaven. Just like the promised city, just like the city Jerusalem is a picture of the heavenly city. And the temple is a picture of relationship with God in the heavenly city. It's all picture language. It's all like an architect's model that we could have built here on the table that will show us what the building is going to look like in the end. It's just a shadow of the reality, just a model of the reality that's to come. And so the people crossing the wilderness, trying to get into a land where they could put their bags down and rest, is a picture of us going through this life, looking for the place where we can put our bags down and rest. That's what Hebrews 3 and 4 is about. Did you come to Hebrews 3 and 4 yesterday? That's what it's about, as it picks up that psalm. From verse 7 of Hebrews 3 through to verse 11 of Hebrews 4 is this great argument based on Psalm 95. That the Holy Spirit warned them that today, not just any day, but today, that is this day, now, you must listen to the voice of God or you will not enter my rest, verse 11 of Hebrews 3. And so the challenge comes to the Christians to continue, that Hebrews is written to continue to listen to the voice of God lest you fail to enter the rest. And it says, who is it that we're talking about here? Verse 16 of chapter 3. Who were they who heard and rebelled? Were they not all those under Moses led out of Egypt? And with whom was he angry for 40 years? Was it not those who sinned and whose bodies fell in the desert? And to whom did God swear that they would never enter his rest if it wasn't those who disobeyed? So we see that they were not able to enter because of their unbelief. Therefore, since the promise of entering his rest still stands, let us be careful that none of you be found to have fallen short of it. It still is there, you see. Pick it up. I'll keep reading verse 2. For we also have had the gospel preached to us, just as they did. But the message they heard was of no value to them, because when they heard it, they didn't combine it with faith. Now we who have believed enter that rest, just as God has said. So I declare on my oath and my anger, they will never enter my rest. And yet his work has been finished since the creation of the world. Perhaps somewhere he's spoken about the seventh day in these words. And on the seventh day God rested from all his work. And again in the passage above he says, they shall never enter my rest. It still remains that some will enter that rest, and those who formerly had the gospel preached to them did not go in it because of their disobedience. And therefore God again set a certain day, calling it today, when a long time later he spoke through David, as was said before, today if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts. If Joshua had given them rest, God would not have spoken later about another day. There remains then a Sabbath rest for the people of God. Now let's pick up a couple of these ideas, because you see, here we've linked in this passage, you link in the creation story of Genesis and the promised land story of Psalm 95. They're both put together because they're both the rest. Here's the bringing together of it all. What happened on the eighth day of creation? Well, there never has been an eighth day. We are still in the seventh day. God's rest still remains. A new week hasn't started yet. We are still in the seventh day. God has rested from his work of creation. That is what he has done. And when he rescues this group of people, these Israelites out of Egypt, and brings them into the promised land, he is bringing them into his rest. But hundreds of years after bringing them in, David is still warning the people not to miss out on the rest. So it wasn't good enough just to be in the promised land. That didn't give you the rest. You have to be in relationship with God. You have to be freed from the wrath of God, at peace with God, forgiven by God, in relationship with God. That is why David is still saying, if you disobey God's word, well, you're just the same as the people out in the wilderness. You will never get into the rest of God. Today, when you hear his voice, listen to his voice, obey his voice, believe his voice. When you hear the voice of the gospel preached, if you believe it, then you enter into his rest. Verse 3, now we who have believed enter that rest. So it's as you believe the gospel of Jesus Christ, you enter into the promised rest of God. And those who refuse to listen to the voice of God in the gospel of Jesus Christ, those who do not believe and do not obey, they do not enter into the Sabbath rest of the people of God. And that Sabbath rest remains, verse 9. Anyone who enters God's rest also rests from his own work, just as God did from his, and let us therefore make every effort to enter that rest, so that no one will fall by following their example of disobedience. As the word of the gospel is preached, you are invited to lay down your work and labour, to be freed from your enmity, especially the enmity with God, and to come into the rest that God has been enjoying since the beginning of creation. There is what Hebrews 3 and 4 is about. Now we see that the ultimate state of the Christian then is to be a person at rest. Revelation 14. Last verse to look up, friends, as far as I can see in my notes. Revelation 14. Verse 13. Then, 14:13. Then I heard a voice from heaven saying, write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Yes, says the Spirit, they will rest from their labour, for their deeds will follow them. It is in death that we finally come to rest. For we rest from our labours, we rest in God. Well then, what is this Sabbath and resting business about? Here's the summary. One, it's about being a Christian. It's about entering into the relationship with God that was there from the foundation of the world. It's about entering into the seventh day, the day that goes beyond the created world. It's about finding that relationship with God, which we only find in the person of Jesus Christ in the gospel. That's the first thing, it's about being Christian. Secondly, it means that as a human being, and now as a Christian, we will find our own self, not in our work, but in our rest. We find our self, not in work, but in rest. That is, I don't live to work, I work to live. And what is it to live? To live is to rest. It's not to work. The purpose of my life is to rest in God. The purpose of my life is not to work. Now, of course, that is a very important point as we're coming to work after the morning tea, but it's a very important point now. I thought you said 10:30.
Yeah, that's
right. Did you enjoy morning tea? It's a very important point. As people who are moving into professional work, for many, many people in our society here today, many professional people find themselves in their work. So that in our society, when you say to a person, what are you, they nearly always tell you what they do. as part of the character of life today. If we all think, what am I? I am a dentist, I am an engineer, I am a lawyer, I am a... That's what I am. Which, of course, is not what I am. That is what I do. What I am is a human being created in the image of God. What I am is one of God's chosen, saved people living in relationship with Him. That is what I am. What I do is a secondary thing. But we're caught up like that because my personal self-esteem, my worth as an individual, my sense of who I am and how valuable I am, is all caught up with what I do, the work that I do. After all, it occupies 8, 10 hours, 12 hours, 15 hours of every day. My consciousness is all caught up with the jobs that I'm doing. And if I'm successful at the jobs that I'm doing, then I feel successful as a person. And if I fail at the jobs that I'm doing, then I feel a failure as a person. And so I find myself in my work, whereas what the seventh day indicates is I'm not to find my purpose in my work, not to find myself in my work, but in my rest. That is where I come to the reality that God has created for me. My rest, of course, in Him. And third point then is that I must express this self-understanding, if you like, in the way in which I live, so that in taking time off I express that I am a creature who needs refreshment like the rest of the world. I express that I'm a creature of the Creator who Himself takes a day off every week. He only had 1 week so far, work, but takes the day off. I express that I am a redeemed person who is looking forward to the time when I will rest from my labours permanently in God. So the pattern of taking the one day off in seven expresses my faith in my Creator, that He'll actually be able to look after the world without me for a day. And you see, the workaholic actually believes that he's indispensable, that if he stops working, then the world won't produce. Whereas God says, look, knock off for a day and watch, the plants will still come up. Knock off every seventh year and watch, the ground will actually be richer. You think you've got to keep working, you don't have to keep working. I provide for you. You need to learn that I'm the Creator and that you're a creature. The workaholic loses sense of that. He becomes the self-made man who constantly must work because the whole world hangs on his shoulders. Always complaining too about how hard he works. Faith in my Creator is expressed when I take a day off. Accepting that I'm a creature who needs refreshment takes place when I take a day off. Accepting the fact that my purpose in life is heaven, not my work, takes place when I take a day off. Therefore, rest, relaxation, leisure is not a biblical option. It's a biblical imperative. No one day is any more important than any other day. So therefore, the fact that I've got to take it on Saturday or Sunday, Thursday, Wednesday or Friday is an irrelevance. Any day is as good as any other day. And in every day I am to serve the Lord and to rest in fellowship with Him as a Christian. But taking a day off each week, whatever that day may be, is an expression of my understanding of my relationship with God as a creature and as a redeemed person. And so rest, relaxation, is actually commanded of the people of God. And we're very silly if we ignore that command. Well, there we go. That's what I was going to get through before 10:30, which I've just done. Do you want to have the questions? Do you want to have the morning tea? Do you want to come back to questions before we look at work? Joshua, give me wisdom.
That's the question.
A few minutes, questions now. Right. Verse 3, and you need to compare that with verse 9 and 10, which talks about the rest as being in the future. Both are true. When I become a Christian, I enter into that relationship with God, which when I die or the Lord returns, I will continue in for the rest of the eternity. It's not something new that I come to in eternity. So I'm already in heaven now. I've already been raised up with Christ to sit in the heavenly places now, but my body is still here on earth. One day my body will catch up with me. I'm now at rest with God. One day that is all that will be, and my deeds will be done away with.
Oh, yes. The other one is talking about physical rest.
Yep.
Yep.
Yes, it's that same problem over and over again. And the Sabbath one's a funny one, because he's talking about two or three different things at the same time, which all turn out to be the same, but not till you get to heaven does it all fit together like that.
So I think we are remaining in the seventh day now.
Yep. Yes, we do have to obey the seventh day as a commandment. But what does that mean?
Yeah.
Is the trap, right? Because
what does it mean to talk about Sabbath day? We have to rest the day. You can't even work. If anybody works, you have to cut off from people.
That's right.
But in Jesus, he actually tells people that.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.